Chapter 25. Zero-G. Weightlessness. I had never really appreciated those terms and that reality before. Our living pod was opaqued to the point that the rich evening light glowed as if through thick parchment. Once again, I had the impression of being in a warm heart. Once again, I realized how much Aeneia was in my heart. At first, the encounter bordered on the clinical, as Aeneia carefully removed my clothes and expected the healing surgical scars, gently touched my repaired ribs, and ran her palm down my back. "I should shave," I said, "and shower." "Nonsense," whispered my friend. "I've given you sponge and sonic baths every day, including this morning. You're perfectly clean, my dear. And I like the whiskers." She moved her fingers across my cheek. We floated above the soft and rounded cubby shelves. I helped Aeneia out of her shirt, trousers, and underwear. As each piece came clear, she kicked it through the air into the cubby drawer, shutting the fiber panel with her bare foot when everything was inside. We both chuckled. My own clothes were still floating in the quiet air, the sleeves of my shirt gesturing in slow motion. "I'll get the..." I began.
"No, you won't," said Aeneia, and pulled me closer.
Even kissing demands new skills in zero-G. Aeneia's hair coiled around her head in a sunlit corona as I held her face in my hands and kissed her. Her lips, eyes, cheeks, forehead, and lips again. We began tumbling slowly, brushing the smooth and glowing wall. It was as warm as my dear friend's flesh. One of us pushed off and we tumbled together into the middle of the oval pod space. Our kissing became more urgent. Each time we moved to hold the other more tightly, we would begin to pivot around an invisible center of mass. Arms and legs entangled as we pressed tighter and rotated more quickly. Without disentangling or interrupting our kiss, I held out one arm, waited for the flesh-warm walls to reach us, and stopped our tumble. The contact pushed us away from the curved, warmly glowing wall and sent us spinning very slowly toward the center again. Aeneia broke our kiss and moved her head back a moment, still holding my arms, regarding me from arm's length. I had seen her smile 10,000 times in the last 10 years of her life, had thought that I knew all of her smiles. But this one was deeper, older, more mysterious, and more mischievous than any I had seen before.
"Don't move," she whispered,
and pushing softly against my arm for leverage, rotated in space. "Aeneia," was all I could say, and then I could say nothing. I closed my eyes, oblivious of everything except sensation. I could feel my darling's hands tight on the backs of my legs, pulling me closer to her. After a moment, her knees came to rest against my shoulders, her thighs bumping softly against my chest. I reached out to the hollow of her back and pulled her closer, sliding my cheek along the strong muscle of her inner thigh. At Taliesin West, one of the cooks had owned a tabby cat. Many evenings when I was sitting alone out on the western terrace, watching the sunset and feeling the stones lose their day's heat, waiting for the hour when Aeneia and I could sit in her shelter and talk about everything and nothing, I would watch the cat lap slowly from her bowl of cream. I visualized that cat now, but within minutes I could visualize nothing but the immediate and overpowering sense of my dear friend opening to me. Of the subtle taste of the sea, of our movements like the tide rising, of all of my senses being centered in the slow but growing sensation at the core of me. How long we floated this way, I have no idea. Such overwhelming excitement is like a fire that consumes time. Total intimacy is an exemption from the space-time demands of the universe. Only the growing prerogatives of our passion and the ineluctable need to be even closer than this penultimate closeness marked the minutes of our lovemaking. Aeneia opened her legs wider, moved away, released me with her mouth but not her hand.
We pivoted again in the sepia light, her tight fingers and my excitement the center of our slow rotation. We kissed, lips moist, Ania's grasp tightening around me. "Now," she whispered. I obeyed. If there is a true secret to the universe, it is this. These first few seconds of warmth and entry and complete acceptance by one's beloved. We kissed again, oblivious of our slow tumbling, the rich light taking on a heart warmth around us. I opened my eyes long enough to see Ania's hair swirling like Ophelia's cloak in the wine-dark sea of air in which we floated. It was indeed like holding my beloved in deep salty water, buoyed up and weightless, the warmth of her around me like the rising tide, our movements as regular as the surf against warm sand. "Oops," whispered Ania, after only a moment of this perfection. I paused in my kissing long enough to assess what was separating us. "Newton's law," I whispered against her cheek. "For every action," whispered Ania, chuckling softly, holding my shoulders like a swimmer pausing to rest. "An equal and opposite reaction," I said, smiling until she kissed me again. "Solution," whispered Ania. Her legs closed tight around my hips, her breasts floated between us, the nipples teasing my chest. Then she lay back, again the swimmer, floating this time, her arms spread but her fingers still interlaced with mine. We continued to pivot slowly around our common center of gravity, a slow tumble, my head coming over and down and around like a rider on a porpoise, doing slow cartwheels in the sunlit depths. But I was no longer interested or aware of the elegant ballistics of our lovemaking, but only in the lovemaking. We moved faster in the warm sea of air. Some minutes later, Ania released my hands, moved upright and forward as we tumbled together, still moving, sank her short nails into my back, even while she kissed me with a wild urgency, and then moved her mouth away to gasp and cry out once softly. At the same instant as her cry, I felt the warm universe of her close around me with that short, tight throb, that intimate, shared pulse. A second later, it was my turn to gasp, to cling to her as I throbbed within her, to whisper into her salty neck and floating hair, "Ania, Ania," a prayer. My only prayer then, my only prayer now. For a long time we floated together, even after we had become two people again rather than one. Our legs were still intertwined, our fingers stroking and holding one another. I kissed her throat and felt her pulse like a memory echo against my lips. She ran her fingers through my sweaty hair. I realized that for this moment, nothing in the past mattered. Nothing terrible in the future mattered. What mattered was her skin against me, her hand holding me, the perfume of her hair and skin, and the warmth of her breath against my chest. This was Satori. This was truth. Ania kicked away to the pod cubby just long enough to return with a small, warm, and wet towel. We took turns wiping some of the sweat and slickness from us. My shirt floated by, the empty sleeves attempting to swim in the gentle air currents. Ania laughed and lingered in her washing and drying, the simple act quickly turning into something else. "Oops," said Ania, smiling at me. "How did that happen?" "Newton's law," I said. "That makes sense," she whispered. "Then what would be the reaction if I were to do this?" I think we were both surprised by the instant result of her experiment. "We have hours until we have to meet the others on the tree ship," she said softly. She said something to the living pod, and the curved wall went absolutely transparent. It was as if we were floating among these countless branches and sail-sized leaves, the sun's warmth bathing us one moment and then being submerged in night and stars when we looked out the other side of the clear pod.
"Don't worry," said Aenea. "We can see out, but the exterior is opaque on the outside, reflective."
"How can you be sure?" I whispered, kissing her neck again, seeking the soft pulse. Aenea sighed.
"I guess we can't without going out to look in. Sort of a David Hume problem."
I tried to remember my philosophy readings at Taliesin, recalled our discussions of Berkeley, Hume, and Kant, and chuckled. "There's another way we can check," I said, rubbing my bare feet along her calves and the back of her legs.
"How's that?"
murmured my friend, her eyes closed. "If anyone can see in," I said, floating behind her, rubbing her back without letting her float away. "There's going to be a huge crowd of Ouster angels and Templar tree ships and comet farmers hanging out there in about 30 minutes.
"Really?" said Aenea, eyes still closed. "And why is that?"
I began to show her. She opened her eyes.
"Oh, my," she said softly.
I was afraid that I was shocking her.
"Rawl," she whispered.
I said, not stopping what I was doing. I closed my eyes.
"Maybe you're right about the pod being reflective on the outside."
She whispered and then sighed again, more deeply this time.
I said.
She grabbed my ears and floated around, pulled herself closer and whispered,
"Why don't we leave the outside transparent and make the inside wall reflective?"
My eyes snapped open.
"Just kidding," she whispered,
and pushed away from the pod wall, pulling me with her into the central sphere of warm air. The stars blazed around us. We wore formal black outfits to the dinner party and conference on the Yggdrasil. I was tense with excitement to be aboard one of the legendary tree ships, and it was a bit of an anticlimax when I realized that I had not noticed when we had crossed from the biosphere branches to the tree ship trunk. It was only when hundreds of us were gathered on a series of platforms and opened pods, when the tree ship had actually cast off and moved away from the encircling city-sized leaves, province-sized branches, and continent-sized trunks, that I realized that we were aboard and moving. The Yggdrasil must have been a bit more than a kilometer in length, from the narrowed crown of the tree to the resplendent root system of boiling fusion energy at its base. A bit of gravity returned under drive, probably only a few percentage points of microgravity, but it was still disconcerting after so much zero-G. It did help with our orientation, though, the scores of us able to sit at tables and look one another in the eyes rather than float for a polite position. I thought of Aenea and our last hours together and blushed at this thought. There were tables and chairs on the multi-tiered platforms, and many who were not seated there thronged on the flimsy suspension bridges that connected platforms to more far-flung branches, or on the helixes of spiral stairways, winding up through branches, leaves, and binding the central trunk like vines, or hung from swing vines and leafy bowers. Aenea and I were seated at the round central table along with the true voice of the tree, Hetmastine, the ouster leaders, and 20 of other Templars, refugees from Tien Shan and others. I was on Aenea's immediate left. The Templar dignitaries were seated to her right. Even now I can remember the names of most of the others present at the central table. Besides the captain of the tree ship, Hetmastine, there were 6 other Templars there, including Ket Rostine, introduced as the true voice of the Star Tree, High Priest of the Muir, and spokesman of the Templar Brotherhood. The 12 ousters at the main table included Sistenge Cordwell and Navsun Hamnim. But there were others who looked little like these tall, thin ouster archetypes, Am Chepeta and Kent Quinkent. 2 shorter, darker ousters, a married couple, I thought, with lively eyes and no webs between their fingers. Sion Quintana Ka'an, a female, who was either wearing a resplendent robe of bright feathers, or who had been born with them, and her blue-feathered partners Paul Urey and Morgan Bottoms. Two others better fit the ouster image, Drivenj Nika-Agat and Palu Koror, for they were vacuum-adapted and wore their silvery skin suits through the entire banquet. There were four of the Hebronese Sineschi Aluit present, L.E. Iowan and Uoiol, whom I had met at the earlier gathering, as well as another pair of the willowy green figures introduced by Ania as Ealoii and Niilu. I could only assume that the four were related or marriage-bound in some complex way. The alien Ekeretelai appeared to be missing until Ania pointed to a place far out among the branches where the microgravity was even less, and there, between the gossamers and glowbirds, floated the platelet beings. Even the Ergbinders who were controlling the tree ship's containment field were present by proxy in the form of three Mobius cubes with translator disks embedded in their black matrices. Father Captain Federico de Soya sat to my left, and his aide, Sergeant Gregorius, sat to the left of him. Next to the sergeant sat Colonel Fedman Kassad in his formal force black uniform, looking like a hollow from the deep hegemony past. Beyond Kassad sat the Thunderbolt Sow, as upright and proud as the old Force warrior to her right, while next to her, eyes bright and attentive, sat Getsuang Ungwang Lopsang Tenjin Gyapso Sising Wangyar Chungpa Mape Depal Sangpo, the boy Dalai Lama. All of the other refugees from Tian Shan were somewhere on the dining platform, and I saw Lomo Dondrub, Labsang Samten, George and Jigme, Hariyuki, Kenshiro, Wojtek, Vicky, Kuku K, and others present at the main table. Just beyond the Templars, around the table from us, were A. Bedek, Rachel, and Theo Bernard. Rachel never took her eyes off Colonel Kassad, except to look at Ania when she spoke. It was as if the rest of us were not there. Tiny Templar servants, whom Ania whisperingly described as crew clones, served water and stronger drinks, and for a while there was the usual murmuring and polite pre-dinner conversation. Then there was a silence as thick as prayer. When Ket Rostin, the true voice of the Star Tree, stood to speak, everyone else rose as well. "My friends," said the small hooded figure, "fellow brothers in the Muir, honored ouster allies, sentient sisters and brothers of the ultimate life tree, human refugees from the packs, and—" The true voice of the Star Tree bowed in Ania's direction. "The most revered one who teaches. As most of us gathered here know, what the Shrike Church once called the Days of Atonement, with us now for almost three centuries, are almost done. The true voices of the Brotherhood of the Muir have followed the path of both prophecy and conservation, awaiting events as they came to pass, planting seeds as the soil of revelation has proved fertile. In these coming months and years, the future of many races, not just the human race, will be determined. Although there are those among us now who have been granted the gift of being able to glimpse patterns of the future, probabilities tossed like dice on the uneven blanket of space and time, even these gifted ones know that no single future has been preordained for us or our posterity. Events are fluid. The future is like smoke from a burning forest, waiting for the wind of specific events and personal courage to blow the sparks and embers of reality this way or that. This day, on this tree ship, on the reborn and rechristened Yggdrasil, we shall determine our own paths to our own futures. My own prayer to the life force glimpsed by the Muir is not just that the Star Tree biosphere survives, not just that the Brotherhood survives, not just that our ouster brethren survive. Not just that our hunted and harried, sentient cousins of the Sineschi and the Ekeretelai and the Urg and the Zeppelin survive. Not just that the species known as humankind survives, but that our prophecies begin to be realized this day, and that all species of beloved life, humanity no more than the soft-shelled turtle or Mare Infinitus lantern mouth, the jumping spider and the Tesla tree, the Old Earth Raccoon and the Maui Covenant Thomas Hawk, that all species beloved of life join in rebirth of respect as distinct partners in the universe's growing cycle of life. The true voice of the Star Tree turned to Aenea and bowed. Revered one who teaches, we are gathered here today because of you. We know from our prophecies, from those in our brotherhood and elsewhere who have touched the nexus known as the void which binds, that you are the best single hope of reconciliation between humanity and Kor, between humankind and otherkind. We also know that time is short, and that the immediate future holds the potential for both the beginnings of this reconciliation and our liberation, or for near total destruction. Before any decisions can be made, there are those among us who must ask their final questions. Will you join in discussion with us now? Is this the time to speak of those things which must be spoken of and understood before all the worlds and abodes of Auster and Templar and Pax and disparate humankind join in the final battle for humanity's soul? Yes, said Aenea. The true voice of the Star Tree sat down. Aenea stood, waited. I slipped my scriber from my vest pocket.
Auster Sistench Cordwell. Aenea, most respected one who teaches, can you tell us with any certainty whether the biosphere, our Star Tree, will be spared destruction and the Pax assault?
Aenea,
I cannot, Freedman Cordwell, and if I could, it would be wrong for me to speak of it. It is not my role to predict probabilities in the great epicycles of chaos which are the futures. I can say without doubt that the next few days and weeks will determine whether this amazing biosphere shall survive or not. Our own actions will, to a great extent, determine this. But there is no single correct course of action. And if I may ask a question, there are friends of mine here new to the Star Tree and to Auster Space. It would help in our discussion if one of our hosts were to explain the background of the Auster race, and of the biosphere and other projects, and of the Auster and Templar philosophy.
Auster Siang Kintana Ka'an.
I would be pleased to speak to our new guests, friend Aenea. It is important that all present in these deliberations understand our stake in the outcome. As all of our Auster and Templar brethren here well know, the Auster race was created more than 800 years ago, in scores of star systems far flung from one another. Human seed ships with colonists trained in the genetic arts were sent out from Old Earth system in the great pre-Hegira expansions. These seed ships were, for the most part, slower than light craft. Fleets of crude Bussard ramjets, solar sailing ships, ion scoops, nuclear pulse propulsion craft, gravity-launched Dyson spherelets, laser-driven containment sailing ships. Only a few dozen of the later seed ships were early Hawking Drive C-plus craft. These colonists, our ancestors, most traveling in cold sleep deeper than cryogenic fugue, were among the best arnists, nanotechs, and genetic engineers Old Earth System had to offer. Their missions were to find habitable worlds and, in the absence of terraforming technology, to bioengineer and nanotech the millions of Old Earth life forms frozen aboard their ships into viable adaptations for those worlds. As we know, a few of the seed ships reached habitable worlds— New Earth, Tau Ceti, Barnard's World. Most, however, reached worlds in systems where no life forms could survive. The colonists had a choice. They could continue on, hoping that their ship life support systems would sustain them for more long decades or centuries of travel. or they could use their gene engineering skills to adapt themselves and their Ark's embryos to conditions far harsher than the original seed ship planners had imagined. And so they did. Using the most advanced methods of nanotechnology, methods quashed on old Earth and the early hegemony by the Technocore, these human beings adapted themselves to wildly inhospitable worlds, and to the even less hospitable dark spaces between worlds and stars. Within centuries, the use of Hawking Drive had spread to most of these far-flung swarms of ouster colonists, but their urge to find friendlier worlds had faded. What they now wanted was to continue to adapt, to allow all of old Earth's orphans to adapt, to whatever conditions the place and space offered them. And with this new mission grew their philosophy, our philosophy, almost religious in fervor, of spreading life throughout the galaxy, throughout the universe. Not just human life, not just old Earth life forms, but life in all of its infinite and complex variations. A few of our visitors here tonight may not know that the end goal of both us ousters and our Templar brethren is not just the biosphere star tree, which we can see above us even as we speak, but a day in which air and water and life shall fill almost all of the space between the star tree and the yellow sun we see burning above us. The Brotherhood of the Muir and our loose confederations of ousters want nothing less than to turn the surface, seas, and atmosphere of every world around every star green with life. More than that, we work to see the galaxy grow green, tendrils reaching to nearby galaxies, superstrings of life. One byproduct of this philosophy, and the reason that the Church and the Pax seek to destroy us, is that for centuries we have been tailoring human evolution to fit the demands the environment gives us. So far, there are no distinct and separate species of humankind different than Homo sapiens. That is, all of us here could, if both parties were willing, interbreed with any Pax human or Templar human. But the differences are growing, the genetic separation widening. Already, there are forms of ouster humanity so different that we border on new human species. And those differences are passed along genetically to our offspring. This the Church cannot abide. And so we are engaged in this terrible war, deciding whether humankind must remain one species forever, or whether our celebration of diversity in the universe can be allowed to continue.
Ania. Thank you, Free Woman Sian Quintana Ka'an. I am sure that this has been helpful for my friends who are new to ouster space, as well as important for the rest of us to remember as we make these momentous decisions. Does anyone else wish to speak?
Dalai Lama.
Friend Ania, I have a comment and a question of you. The Pax's promise of immortality seduced even me into considering, for a few moments only, converting to their Christian faith. All here love life. It is the bright thread of our commonality. Can you tell us why the cruciform is bad for us? And I must say, the fact that it is a symbiote or parasite does not make it that unthinkable to me or many others. Our bodies have many life forms, the bacteria in our gut, for instance, which feed off us yet allow us to live. Friend Ania, what is the cruciform, and why should we shun it?
Ania closes her eyes for only a second, sighs, and opens them to face the boy.
Your Holiness, the cruciform was born out of the Technocore's desperation following Mayna Gladstone's attack on them in the hours before the fall of the Farcasters. The Technocore, as I have discussed with all of you in different forums, lives and thinks only as a parasite.
In that sense, humankind has long been a symbiotic partner of the core. Our technology was created and limited by core designs. Our societies have been created, altered, and destroyed by core plans and core fears. Our existence as human beings has largely been defined by the endless dance of fear and parasitism with the core AI entities. After the fall, after the core lost control of the hegemony via its data spheres and forecasters, after the core lost its greatest computing engine, its direct parasitism on the billions of human brains as they transited the void which binds via the so-called forecasters, the Technocore had to find a new way to exploit humankind, and it had to find it quickly. Thus the Cruciform. This is nanotechnology at its most refined and most injurious. Where our ouster friends used advanced genetic engineering combined with nanotechnology to advance the cause of life in the universe, the Technocore uses it to advance the cause of core hyperparasitism. Each cruciform is made up of billions of core-connected nanotech entities, each in contact with other cruciforms and the core via a terrible misuse of the void which binds medium. The Technocore has known of the void for a millennium and used it, misused it for almost as long. The so-called Hawking drive tore holes in the void. Then forecasters ripped at the essential fabric of the void. The core-driven information metasphere and instantaneous fatline medium stole information from the void which binds in ways that blinded entire races, destroyed millennia of memories. But it is the cruciform that is the core's most cynical and terrible misuse of the void medium. What makes the cruciform seem most miraculous to most of us is not its ability to restore some form of life. Technology has offered variations of that for centuries, but its ability to restore the personality and memories of the deceased person. When one realizes that this demands information storage capabilities in excess of 6 × 10²³ bytes for each human resurrected, the fact of cruciform seems truly miraculous. Those in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church who know the core's secret role in all resurrections ascribe this staggering, impossible computing power to the core's megasphere storage potential. But the core has nowhere near that computing power. Indeed, even in the heyday of the Ultimate's attempt to create the perfect artificial computing entity, the Ultimate Intelligence, the analyzer of all variables, no AI or series of AIs in the core had the ability to store sufficient bytes for even one human body personality to be recorded and resurrected. In fact, even if the core had such information storage capability, it would never have the energy necessary to reform atoms and molecules into the precise living entity that is the body of a human being, much less reproduce the intricate waveform dance that is a human personality. Resurrection of a single person was and remains impossible for the core. That is, it was impossible, unless they further ravaged the void which binds, that transtemporal, interstellar medium for the memory and emotions of all sentient races, which the core did without a backward glance. It is the void which binds that records the individual wavefront personalities of those humans wearing cruciforms. The cruciform itself is little more than a core-spawned nanotech data transfer device. But every time a person is resurrected, parts of thousands of personalities, human and otherwise, are erased from the more permanent record that is the void which binds. Those of you who have taken communion with me, who have learned the language of the dead and of the living, who have attempted to hear the music of the spheres and have pondered the potential of taking that first step through the void which binds, you understand the terrible savagery this vandalism represents. It must stop. I must stop it. Anea closes her eyes for a long moment, then opens them again and continues.
But this is not the only evil of the cruciform. I say again, the core AI entities are parasites. They cannot stop themselves from being parasites. Besides providing control of humanity via the Church, and if all else fails, by administering pain to individuals via the cruciforms, there is another reason the AIs have offered humanity resurrection via these cruciform parasites. With the fall of the Farcasters, the use of trillions of human neurons in the Corps' ultimate datasphere-connected ultimate intelligence effort was interrupted. Without the ruse of the Farcasters, by which to attach themselves like leeches on human brains, to steal the very life energy of neurons and holistic wavefronts from their human hosts, to hook billions of human minds into parallel computing devices, the Ultimate Intelligence Project had to stop. With the cruciforms, this parasitism on the human brain has been resumed. But it is now more complex than mere data space connections of billions of human minds in parallel for the Corps' purposes. Centuries ago, as far back as the 20th century AD, human researchers dealing with similar neural networks comprised of pre-AI silicon intelligences discovered that the best way to make a neural network creative was to kill it. In those dying seconds, even in the last nanoseconds of a sentient or near-sentient conscience's existence, the linear, essentially binary processes of neural net computing jumped barriers, became wildly creative in the near-death liberation from off-on, binary-based processing. War game computer simulations, as far back as the late 20th century, showed that dying neural nets made unexpected but highly creative decisions. A primitive, pre-sentient AI controlling a battered seagoing fleet in a simulated war game, for instance, suddenly sank its own damaged ships so that the remnants of its fleet could escape. Such was the genius of dying, non-linear neural net creativity. The Corps has always lacked such creativity. Essentially, it has the linear, serial architecture of the serial CPUs from which it evolved, coupled with the obsessive, non-creative mentality of the ultimate parasite. But with the cruciform, that great neural networked core computing device, which is the Christian cruciformed part of the human race, has found a source for almost unlimited creativity. All they need for a creativity catalyst is the death of large parts of the neural net, and humans provide that in abundance. The core AIs hover like vampires, waiting to feed off the dying human brains, sucking the marrow of creativity from humankind's mental bones. And when the deaths fall below the needed level, or when their core computing demand for creative solutions rises, they orchestrate a few million more deaths. Odd accidents occur. Humans' health is not what it was a few centuries ago. Death from cancer, heart disease, and the like are on the rise. And there are more clever forms of arranged mortality. Even with the Pax imposition of peace within the human interstellar empire, the incidents of violent death are on the rise. New forms of death are introduced. The Archangel starships are such a beginning. Death is a cheap commodity for the born-again Christian, but it is a rich source of orchestrated creativity for the Corps. And thus the cruciform. And thus, I believe, at least one reason to eliminate the things from the human body and the human soul.
When Aenea quits speaking, there is a long silence. Leaves on the tree ship whisper in the breeze of circulating air. None of the hundreds of humans or hominids on the many platforms, branches, bridges, or stairways seem to blink. So intense are their gazes as they stare at my friend. Finally, a single, strong voice speaks. Father Captain DeSoya. I still wear the collar and carry the vows of a Catholic priest. Is there no hope for my church? Not the Church of the Pax, held under technocore control and the conceit of greedy men and women, but the Church of Jesus Christ and the hundreds of millions who followed his word? Aenea.
Federico,
Father de Soya, it is for you to answer this question. You and the faithful like you. But I can tell you that there are billions of men and women today, some who wear the cruciform, more who do not, who yearn to return to a church which concerns itself with spiritual matters, with the teachings of Christ and the deepest matters of the heart, rather than with this obsession with false resurrection.
Templar Hetmestin. Revered one who teaches, if I may change the subject from the cosmic and theological to the most personal and petty.
Ania. Nothing of which you speak could be petty, true voice of the tree Hetmestin.
Templar Hetmestin.
I was on the Hyperion pilgrimage with your mother, revered one who teaches.
Ania.
She spoke to me of you often, true voice of the tree Hetmestin.
Templar Hetmestin.
Then you know that the Lord of Pain, the Shrike, came to me as the pilgrims were crossing Hyperion Sea of Grass on the wind wagon, one who teaches. It came to me and carried me forward in time and across space, to this time, to this place.
Ania.
Yes.
Templar Hetmestin.
And in my conversations with you, and with my brethren in the Brotherhood of the Muir, I have come to understand that it is my fate to serve the Muir and the cause of life in this age, as it was prophesied centuries ago by our own seers into the void which binds. But in these days, and despite the best efforts of my brothers and other kind friends among the ousters, I have heard of Martin Silenus's epic poem and found an edition of the Cantos.
Ania.
That is unfortunate, true voice of the tree Hetmestin. My uncle Martin wrote that to the best of his knowledge, but his knowledge was incomplete.
Templar Hetmestin.
But in the Cantos, revered one who teaches, it says that the pilgrims in their day, and my friend Colonel Kassad has confirmed that this was the case, that they find me on Hyperion in the Valley of the Time Tombs, and that I die shortly after they find me.
Ania.
This is true in the context of the Cantos, but...
Templar Hetmestin, holding up one hand to silence my friend.
It is not the inevitability of my return through time to the pilgrimage on Hyperion, nor my inevitable death that worries me, revered one who teaches. I understand that this is just one possible future for me, however probable or desirable. But what I wish to clarify is the truth of my last words according to the old poet's Cantos. Is it true that immediately before dying I will cry out, I am the true chosen, I must guide the tree of pain during the time of atonement?
Ania.
This is what is written in the Cantos, true voice of the tree Hetmestin.
Templar Hetmestin, smiling under his hood.
And this time is near, revered one who teaches? Will you be using this Yggdrasil as the tree of pain for our atonement, as the prophecies attest?
Ania.
I will. True voice of the tree, Hetmestin. I will be leaving to carry out that atonement within standard days. I formally ask that the Yggdrasil be the instrument of our voyage and the instrument of that atonement. I will be inviting many among us here tonight to join me on that final voyage, and I formally ask you, true voice of the tree, Hetmestin, if you will captain the tree ship Yggdrasil, forever after known as the Tree of Pain, on this voyage.
Templar Hetmestin,
I formally accept your invitation and agree to captain the tree ship Yggdrasil on this mission of atonement. O revered one who teaches.
There are several minutes of silence.
Foreman Jigme Norbu.
Ania, George and I have a question.
Ania.
Yes, Jigme?
Foreman Jigme Norbu.
You have taught us about the Technocore's quiet genocide on such worlds as Hebron, Cum Riad, and others. Well, not genocide exactly, because the populations have been put in a sort of sleeping death, but a terrible kidnapping.
Ania.
Yes?
Foreman Jigme Norbu.
Has this happened to our beloved Tian Shan, the Mountains of Heaven, since we left Ania? Have our friends and families been silenced with this core death wand and been carried away to some labyrinthine world?
Ania. Yes, Jigme. I am sad to say that it has happened. The bodies are being transported off-world even as we speak.
Cuckoo say.
Why? For what reason are these populations being kidnapped? The Jews, the Muslims, the Hindus, the atheists, the Marxists, and now our beautiful Buddhist world. Is the Pax intent on destroying all other faiths?
Ania. That is the Pax's and Church's motivation, Cuckoo. For the Technocore, it is a much more complicated matter. Without the cruciform parasite on these non-Christian populations, the Core cannot use these humans in its dying neural net. But by storing these billions of people in their false death, the Core can utilize their minds in its huge parallel processing neural network. It is a mutually beneficial deal. The Church, who carries out much of the removal work, is no longer threatened by non-believers. The Core, who brings the sleep death and carries out the storage in the labyrinths, gains new circuits in its ultimate intelligence network.
Foreman George Sarong.
Is there no hope, then? Can we do nothing to help our friends?
Ouster, Navson Hamnim.
Excuse me for interrupting, M. Sarong, M. Ania. But we should explain to our friends that when the time comes for our ouster swarms and Templar allies to take the offensive against the Pax, our first objective is to liberate the many labyrinthine worlds where these populations are kept in silent storage and to attempt to revive them.
The Dorji Famo, loudly.
Revive them? How is this to happen? How can anyone revive them?
Ania. By striking directly at the Technocore.
Lomo Dondrup.
And where is the Technocore, Ania? Tell me, and I will go there now and do battle with these AI cowards.
Ania. The true location of the Technocore has been the AI's best-kept secret since the entities left Old Earth 1,000 standard years ago, Lomo. Their actual physical location has been hidden since then. Their secrecy is their best defense against the hosts which might turn against their parasites.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
CEO Mena Gladstone was convinced that the Core dwelt in the interstices of the Farcaster medium, like invisible spiders in an unseen web. It is the reason she authorized the death bombing of the Space Portal Farcaster network. To strike at the Core. Was she wrong? Were the Farcasters destroyed for nothing?
Ania. She was wrong, Fedmon. The physical location of the Core was not within the Farcaster medium, which is the fabric of the void which binds. But the destruction of the Farcasters was not in vain. It deprived the Core of the parasite medium upon which they fed on human minds, while silencing part of their megasphere data network.
Lomo Dondrup.
But Ania, you know where the Core resides?
Ania. I believe I do.
Lomo Dondrup.
Will you tell us, so that we can attack them with our teeth and nails and bullets and plasma weapons?
Ania. I will not say at this time, Lomo. Not until I am certain. And the Core cannot be attacked with physical weapons, just as it cannot be entered by physical entities.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
So once again they are impervious to our attacks, free from confrontation?
Ania. No, neither impervious nor free from confrontation. If the fates allow, I will personally carry the attack to the physical Core. Indeed, that attack has already begun in ways that I hope to make clear later. And I promise you that I will confront the AIs in their lair.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
Emania, Bronze Child, may I ask another question relating to my own fate and future?
Ania, I will endeavor to answer, Colonel, while repeating my reluctance to discuss specifics of a topic as fluid as our future.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
Reluctant or no, child, I believe I deserve an answer to this question. I too have read these damned cantos. In them, it says that I followed the apparition Moneta into the future while fighting the Shrike. trying to prevent it from slaughtering the other pilgrims. This was true. Some months ago I arrived here. Moneta disappeared, but has reappeared in the younger version of this woman who calls herself Rachel Weintraub. But the cantos also state that I will soon join in terrible battle with legions of shrikes, will die, and will be entombed in the newly built time tomb called the Crystal Monolith on Hyperion, where my body travels back in time with Moneta as my companion. How can this be, Emenia? Have I come to the wrong time? The wrong place?
Ania. Colonel Kassad, friend and protector of my mother and the other pilgrims, be assured that all proceeds according to whatever plan there is. Uncle Martin wrote the cantos given what revelation there was granted to him. Not all details of your life or mine were available to him. Indeed, he was told precious little of what was to transpire outside of his presence. I can say this to you, Colonel Kassad. The battle with the Shrike is true, however metaphorically rendered. One possible future for you is to die in battle with the Shrike, with many Shrike-like warriors, and to be placed in the Crystal Monolith after a hero's funeral. But if this were come to pass, it would be after many years and many other battles. There is work for you to do in the days, months, years, and decades yet to come. I ask you now to accompany me on the Yggdrasil when I depart in 3 days. That will be the first step toward these battles.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad, smiling.
But you deflect the question somewhat, Emenia. May I ask you, will the Shrike be on your Tree of Pain when it leaves in 3 standard days' time?
Ania, I believe it will, Colonel Kassad.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
You have not told us here tonight, Emenia, what the Shrike is, where it truly comes from, what its role in this centuries-old and centuries-to-come game is.
Ania, that is correct, Colonel. I have not told anyone here tonight.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
Have you ever told anyone, child?
Ania. No.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
But you know the origin of the Shrike.
Ania. Yes. Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
Will you tell us, Braun Lamia's child?
Ania. I would prefer not to, Colonel. Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
But you will if asked again, will you not? At least you will answer my direct questions on the matter?
Ania nods silently. I see tears in her eyes.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
The Shrike first appears in that same far future in which I do battle with it, as per the cantos. Is this not correct, Emenia? That future in which the Corps is making its last-ditch stand against its enemies.
Ania. Yes. Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
And the Shrike is, will be, a construct, is it not? A created thing, a Corps-created thing.
Ania. This is accurate.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
It will be a strange amalgam of Corps technological wizardry, void which binds energy, and the cybrid recycled personality of a real human being, won't it, Emenia?
Ania. Yes, Colonel. It will be all those things and more.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
And the Shrike will be created by the Corps, but will become a servant and avatar of other powers, entities, will it not?
Ania. Yes.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
In truth, Ania, would you agree that the Shrike will be a pawn of both sides, of all sides, in this war for the soul of humankind? This war that leaps back and forth across time like a 4-dimensional chess game?
Ania. Yes, Colonel. Although not a pawn. A knight, perhaps.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
All right, a knight. And this cybrid, void which binds connected, arnied, DNA-engineered, nanotech-enhanced, terribly mutated knight. It starts with the personality of a single warrior, does it not? Perhaps an opponent in this 1,000-year game?
Ania. Do you need to know this, Colonel?
There is no greater hell than seeing the precise details of one's...
Colonel Fedmon Kassad, softly.
Of one's future? Of one's own death? Of one's fate?
I know that, Ania, daughter of my friend Braun Lamia. I know that you have carried such terrible certitudes and visions with you since before you were born. Since the days when your mother and I crossed the seas and mountains of Hyperion toward what we thought was our fate with the Shrike. I know that it has been very difficult for you, Ania, my young friend. Harder than any of us here could imagine. None of us could have borne up under such a burden. But still, I want to know this part of my own fate. And I believe that my years of service in the cause of this battle, years past and years yet to be given, have earned me the right to an answer. Is the Shrike based on a single human warrior's personality?
Ania. Yes.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad.
Mine? After my death in battle, the core elements, or some power, will incorporate my will, my soul, my persona into that monster, and send it back in time through the crystal monolith?
Ania. Yes, Colonel. Parts of your persona, but only parts of it, will be incorporated into the living construct called the Shrike.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad, laughing.
But I can also live to beat it in battle?
Ania. Yes.
Colonel Fedmon Kassad, laughing harder now, the laughter sounding sincere and unforced.
By God, by the will of Allah, if the universe has any soul, it is the soul of irony. I kill mine enemy, I eat his heart, and the enemy becomes me, and I become him.
There are several more minutes of silence. I see that the tree ship Yggdrasil has turned around and that we are approaching the great curve of the biosphere star tree again. Rachel Weintraub.
Friend Ania, beloved teacher, in the years I have listened to you teach and learned from you, one great mystery has haunted me.
Ania.
What is that, Rachel?
Rachel Weintraub.
Through the void which binds, you have heard the voices of the others. The sentient races beyond our space and time, whose memories and personalities resonate in the void medium. Through communion with your blood, some of us have learned to hear the whispers of the echoes of those voices, of the lions and tigers and bears, as some call them.
Ania,
you are one of my best students, Rachel. You will someday hear these voices clearly, just as you will learn to hear the music of the spheres and to take that first step.
Rachel Weintraub, shaking her head.
That is not my question, friend Ania. The mystery to me has been the presence in human space of an observer or observers sent by those others, those lions and tigers and bears, to study humankind and report back to these distant races. Is the presence of this observer, or these observers, a literal fact?
Ania.
It is.
Rachel Weintraub.
And they were able to take on the form of human or ouster or Templar?
Ania.
The observer or observers are not shapeshifters, Rachel. They chose to come among us in some sort of mortal form, that is true, much as my father was mortal but cybrid-born.
Rachel Weintraub.
And this observer or these observers have been watching us for centuries?
Ania.
Yes.
Rachel Weintraub.
Is that observer, or one of these observers, with us here today, on this tree ship, or at this table?
Ania hesitates.
Rachel, it is best that I say nothing more at this time. There are those who would kill such an observer in an instant to protect the packs or to defend what they think it means to be human. Even saying that such an observer exists puts that entity at great risk. I am sorry. I promise you that this mystery will be solved in the not-too-distant future, and the observer or observer's identity revealed. Not by me, but by the observer or observers themselves.
Templar True Voice of the Star Tree, Ket Rosteen.
Brothers in the Muir, respected ouster allies,
Honored human guests, beloved sentient friends, revered one who teaches. We shall finish this discussion at another time and in another place. I take it as a consensus of those among us that Emania's request for the tree ship Yggdrasil to depart for Pax Space in 3 standard days is agreed to, and that, with luck and courage, thus shall be fulfilled the ancient Templar prophecies of the Tree of Pain and the Time of Atonement for all children of Old Earth. Now we will finish our meal and speak of other things. This formal meeting is adjourned, and what remains of our short voyage must be friendly conversation, good food, and the sacrament of real coffee grown from beans harvested on Old Earth, our common home, the good earth. This meeting is adjourned. I have spoken.
Later that evening, in the warm light of our private cubby, Ania and I made love, spoke of personal things, and had a late second supper of wine and zygote cheese and fresh bread. Ania had gone off to the kitchen cubby for a moment and returned with 2 crystal bulbs of wine. Offering me one, she said,
"Here, Rol, my beloved. Take this and drink."
"Thanks," I said without thinking, and started to raise the bulb to my lips. Then I froze. "Is this... did you..."
"Yes," said Ania. "It is the communion that I have delayed so long for you. Now it is yours if you choose to drink. But you do not have to do this, my love. It will not change the way I feel about you if you choose not to."
Still looking into her eyes, I drained the wine in the bulb. It tasted only of wine. Ania was weeping. She turned her head away, but I had already seen the tears in her lovely dark eyes. I swept her up in my arms, and we floated together in the warm womb light. "Kiddo," I whispered, "what's wrong?" My heart ached as I wondered if she was thinking of the other man in her past, her marriage, the child. The wine had made me dizzy and a bit sick. Or perhaps it was not the wine. She shook her head.
"I love you, Rol."
"I love you, Ania." She kissed my neck and clung to me.
"For what you have just done, for me, in my name, you will be hunted and persecuted."
I forced a chuckle. "Hey, kiddo, I've been hunted and persecuted since the day we rode the hawking mat out of the Valley of the Time Tombs together. Nothing new there. I'd miss it if the packs quit chasing us." She did not smile. I felt her tears against my throat and chest as she clung more tightly.
"You will be the first among all those who follow me, Rol. You will be the leader in the decades and decades of struggle to come. You will be respected and hated, obeyed and despised. They will want to make a god of you, my darling."
"Bullshit," I whispered into my friend's hair. "You know I'm no leader, kiddo. I haven't done anything except follow in all the years we've known each other. Hell, I spend most of my time just trying to catch up."
Ania raised her face to mine. "You were my chosen one before I was born, Rol Endymion. When I fall, you will continue on for us. Both of us must live through you."
I put my heavy finger against her lips. I kissed the tears from her cheeks and lashes. "No talking of falling or living without the other," I commanded her. "My plan is simple, to stay with you forever, through everything, to share everything. What happens to you happens to me, kiddo. I love you, Ania." We floated in the warm air together. I was cradling her in my arms.
"Yes," whispered my friend, hugging me fiercely. "I love you, Rol. Together. Time. Yes."
We quit talking then. I tasted wine and the salt from her tears in our kisses. We made love for more hours, then drifted off to sleep together, floating entwined in the other's embrace like 2 sea creatures. Like 1 wonderfully complex sea creature drifting on a warm and friendly tide.